Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Police repression and police reform. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. For the past year, videos of police shootings have saturated the media, giving urgency to calls for police reform, especially in poor black neighborhoods. But what does reform mean in practice? For example, is so-called broken windows a form of community policing or an excuse for racial profiling? After decades of racism and brutality, Los Angeles has been called a model for police reform, but now it's embroiled in a familiar controversy. Is it time to look beyond the police force and deal with social and economic issues that cops will never be able to resolve? Today's talking point, women and the GOP. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. After a year of high-profile police killings, the time is ripe for reform, and departments around the country are in search of a model. We'll hear about racial profiling, broken windows, and community policing. Today's talking point, Democrats call Donald Trump versus Megyn Kelly another battle in the Republican war against women. Is Carly Fiorina the one who could turn it around? First, this news update. Yesterday, a federal judge ordered a clerk in Kentucky to issue licenses for same-sex marriage. This morning, two gay couples were turned down in Rowan County. Mark Joseph Stern covers law and the courts for Slate. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
How did yesterday's order come about?
Well, after the Supreme Court handed down its decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, which declared that marriage is a fundamental right available to all same-sex couples, the governor of Kentucky declared that all county clerks are required to give out marriage licenses to gay couples. That is, after all, their job, and now same-sex marriage was legal throughout the state and throughout the country. However, several clerks refused, including this one who brought a suit, they said, it's our religious freedom to not give marriage licenses to gay couples. So the ACLU brought a suit. She responded. They sort of duked it out in court. And that led to where we got yesterday, which was a very emphatic ruling by a judge declaring, no, clerks who work for the government, who are paid by taxpayers, have no religious right to refuse service to gay couples.
Now, the clerk in Rowan County is Kim Davis. Does this order only apply to her, or is it broader?
It's a bit confusing right now. As often happens in civil rights suits, the ACLU specifically only brought suit against her, but the wording of the ruling strongly implies that every clerk should be on notice and should be required to serve gay couples. However, if other clerks start following Kim Davis's lead, then we may have to see the ACLU start bringing a number of suits or try to combine them into some kind of class action.
Now, one of the deputies in that office, Nathan Davis, has told reporters that the office was advised by attorneys for the Christian law firm Liberty Counsel to continue refusing. Does it appear that they will continue refusing, and are they trying to appeal this to yet a higher federal court?
It would be a very bad idea for these clerks to refuse to comply with a federal court order, because if they do, the ACLU can ask for them to be held in contempt of court. And it seems that there's a very strong likelihood that the judge would agree. The judge's ruling was emphatic. It was not at all ambiguous. I think that having a clerk hauled off to court, being hauled off to jail after being held in contempt of court, would be a publicity nightmare for same-sex marriage advocates. And I don't think the ACLU will pursue that route quite yet. I do think we'll see an appeal. I do think we'll see more court action on this in the coming months.
Are there other clerks in Kentucky? Are there clerks in other states that are still refusing to issue licenses to same-sex couples?
Yes, absolutely. This is not quite as widespread as we thought it would be, but there are many clerks in states like Alabama who are refusing to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples, and there are states like North Carolina, which have actually passed laws declaring that clerks suddenly have a right to refuse same-sex couples, and if they want, all couples, marriage licenses based on their religious principles.
What exactly are they saying about their religious principles under the advice and counsel, I gather, of Liberty Counsel, this law firm, that relates to the Supreme Court decision? Now, aren't they directly flouting it?
Well, one might say they're directly flouting it if one reads the decision broadly. However, law firms like the Liberty Counsel are trying to argue that so long as the state itself eventually recognizes same-sex marriages, then individual clerks can still refuse to grant marriage licenses. In other words, so long as there's one clerk in a state who will grant marriage licenses to gay couples, the state has not run afoul of Obergefell. That's a pretty tenuous argument. I don't think it will hold water in any courts. It certainly hasn't thus far, but it's what the Liberty Counsel is trying to argue in order to allow as many clerks as possible to refuse service to gay couples.
Obergefell, of course, the name of the court, the case that went through the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the district court in this case is the district judge is David Bunning. What do we know about him?
We don't really know very much about him. He has not served in particularly high-profile cases before. This is his first turn in the spotlight, and I would say he's really acquitted himself quite admirably. He handled this very evenly. When he heard testimony from Kim Davis, he refrained from saying anything derogatory or for being impatient. He was very even-handed across the board, and I think this is the kind of ruling and the kind of judge that liberals and conservatives should respect. He's not doing anything more than enforcing the rule of law. He's certainly not putting his own political opinions ahead of his legal judgment.
And at some length, he goes on to say that she has the right to believe anything she wants to, but her religious convictions cannot excuse her from performing the duties she took an oath to perform as Rowan County Clerk. So this is a pretty clear controversy, and we'll have to see where it goes.
That's exactly right. Just keep in touch with Kim Davis. Keep watching the news, and we'll see if we can get a higher court to reconsider this issue.
Okay. Mark Joseph Stern, again, covering the courts and the law for Slate. Really good to have you on our program. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
In a moment, police repression and police reform on To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To the Point. For decades, the Los Angeles Police Department was the very model of brutality and repression, with white officers patrolling black neighborhoods like an occupying army. The Watts riots of 1965 and the Rodney King uprising of 1992 were in large part rebellions against the LAPD. In 2002, Bill Bratton came to lead the department after a stormy time as police commissioner in New York City. Joe Dominic is an award-winning journalist and associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the City University of New York. He lives in Los Angeles, and his latest book is Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. Joe Dominic, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Warren, always.
So the new chief came from New York with some baggage.
You're referring to Bill Bratton.
Of course.
Yeah. Bill Bratton came to Los Angeles in 2002, as you know, Warren. And he had an incredible success in reforming the culture of the NYPD and dramatically reducing crime. Now, there were a lot of other things going on that added to that, but he really did He really did a really innovative job. One of the things he'll be remembered for is from changing police departments from just reacting to crime to actually working to prevent crime before it happened. But he was working for Rudolph Giuliani, who campaigned on doing something about crime in New York. But it was kind of an egomaniacal, narcissistic guy. Not to say he wasn't effective, and New York doesn't owe him some gratitude. But he was that kind of a guy, and Bill Bratton was getting all of the credit for the dramatic decrease in crime, and Giuliani wanted no part of that. He thought that he should be getting all of the credit. And when Bratton appeared on the cover of Time magazine in a raincoat, it was with the collar up like he was Humphrey Bogart or something, and the headline was people said something like this. I'm quoting very loosely. People said crime, police couldn't do anything about crime. Well, now they've done something, and Bill Bratton is as a result of Bill Bratton's the way Bill Bratton did it.
So that was the end of Bratton in New York.
That was the end of Bratton in New York, and he was also single at the time and being seen at Elaine's, which was the club to be seen at if you were a journalist or or a politician, and he got the tabs gave him the nickname of Broadway Bill. So when he came to Los Angeles, he thought that he would be a sure thing, and it turned out that he wasn't, because they thought he was Broadway Bill instead of the smart police commissioner and now then police chief that he turned out to be.
Okay, now of course he's back in New York, but that's another story. Let's start with
that's
the LAPD,
right,
or go back to the LAPD. Mm-hmm. Once again, okay. For decades it had been, as I described it earlier, a kind of occupying army, which had led to two massive civil disturbances, the worst in the country in the 20th century, and it was ripe for reform.
Well, it certainly was. As you recall, Bratton came in 2002. Now, in between the 1992 riots and 2002, we had two police chiefs, Willie Williams and Bernard Parks, both African-American, and both of them failed miserably in reforming the Los Angeles Police Department. And there was a great consensus at that time that the Los Angeles Police Department desperately needed to be reformed.
And there was an enormous corruption scandal.
That's right. That was the Rampart scandal, which really started about 1997 and came to a head in about 2000, where an anti-gang unit called the Rampart Crash, it was the Rampart Division, which is, as you know, covers PICO Union and is a port of entry for really poor, desperate Central Americans, and they were powerless, and there were gang problems there, and that unit was just doing everything that we all fear that bad police will do.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we need to move
sure,
along.
No
so
problem.
So what did Bradley do? Excuse me. What did Bratton do that he is now remembered for in Los Angeles and which is now being looked at as a kind of model for police reform around the country?
Well, the thing that he did, which I consider to be most important, was he allowed community policing to happen, and he emphasized community policing. He didn't de-emphasize making stop and frisks. He actually increased that. But what he did was he released division captains and said to them, lower crime, and you know the problems in your particular divisions. You do what you need to do to make community policing happen in those divisions. And he unleashed really smart people like Pat Gannon and like the current chief of police, Charlie Beck, who had great success with in South Bureau in implementing real, true community policing.
What about stop and frisk? That had been declared against the Constitution in the state of New York.
Well, that's right. It was declared against the Constitution in New York City because of the way that the NYPD was applying stop and frisk. In 2011, for example, the NYPD stopped 685,000 people and stopped them and frisked them, the vast, vast majority of them being young African-American and people of color. And in that same year, the NYPD stopped 110% of the young guys from 14 to 24, 110% of them. So they stopped more people in that age cohort than actually existed.
So how is it that Bratton ordered captains in Los Angeles to increase stop and frisk at the same time he said he wanted them to implement community policing? What's that?
Well, the two do seem very antithetical to each other. What Bratton did, however, was he's a master of the media, Warren, and he understood that what he had to do was he had to get buy-in from the African American community and from liberal Los Angeles, and so he told the ACLU, he courted all of the African American leaders and said, "You have my ear. You have a complaint, you bring it to me. If I can solve that complaint, I will." And he brought them into the process, so that when stop and frisk increased, he increased it in Los Angeles, there wasn't the uproar that had been going on in New York City.
What about broken windows, another thing that he's associated with? What's that?
Okay, well, both of these techniques, Warren, if done correctly, if done selectively, are useful tools in the police toolbox. For example, if you take broken windows, you don't want to walk out of your apartment building and see somebody urinating on the side of your building. Walk a few steps and see an aggressive homeless panhandler constantly bothering people, and then go a little bit further and a bunch of guys on the corner who are harassing people as they go by. So it can be a good thing. But if you do it, if you apply it rigidly, then you're just causing problems for people, and they don't like it, and that's what was happening in African American and Latino communities in New York City as well.
So the idea is that small things like broken windows can lead to big things. So you try to stop crime by taking care of the small things first.
Yes, if you do it with rationality and proportionality, then it's fine, and you get buy-in from the community, you know, who don't want to see those things either. Then it can be a very good thing. It's the same thing with stop and frisk. If a cop sees somebody that really is acting suspiciously and he may know is somebody who's committed crimes before, then it's a good preventative tool. But when you use it on a mass scale, which is what happened, the bad thing for Bill Bratton was that he legitimized the use of both of these tactics on a mass scale. And that's been a disaster. And that's one of the negative things about his legacy. But to his credit, he lowered stop and frisk his first year back in New York in 2014 by almost 80%. And, you know, took a lot of heat for it. And to his credit, he saw that he needed to do that, and that it was a different time, and he did it.
Okay, Joe Dominic, again, author of Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. We'll come back to him as we go forward with our program. First, let me introduce Ed Flynn. He is the chief of the Milwaukee Police Department. He's been that since January of 2008. Police Commission in Milwaukee unanimously approved a third four-year term for him in July. Ed Flynn, Chief Flynn, thanks so much for being on our program.
Hello.
How difficult is it for police chiefs to institute reforms of the kind that are being called for now that we have seen these video after video of police abuse or what appears to be misuse of force and excessive force so often?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that in order to successfully reform any particular police department, there is a great deal of support needed from the local political culture, as well as cooperation from members of the department. You can't single-handedly impose reform on a police agency, and I think Bill Bratton would be the first one to admit that in both Los Angeles and New York. You've got to have what I call inside outsiders. You've got to have people inside the organization that know it could be more effective, that know it could get more support from the public, that know that a change is necessary. And the great challenge for an external change agent, one that Bill's recognized and I've recognized in five police departments, is that you've got to identify those people and put them in positions of influence where they can accelerate the pace of positive change. There have been enormous policing changes generally in the last 40 years. But obviously, the recent controversies surrounding some of the critical incidents that have received wide publicity have caused a crisis in confidence among those very communities who need police the most and who support police need the most if they are going to be effective in serving that community.
You also need the support, presumably, of the people who work for you, the officers who are the rank and file. You got in trouble with them because you fired one after he behaved in such a way that you thought it was inappropriate. He shot somebody.
Well, it was a really challenging set of circumstances. Yes, a year or so ago, we had our own critical incident where an individual suffering from mental illness had a confrontation with a police officer that ultimately ended in the police officer's shooting to death that young man. Now, the investigation indicated, the DA's investigation indicated that at the point at which the officer used deadly force, he was justified because at that point he'd been disarmed of his baton and was being assaulted with it. And that was the finding, and I think that comported with the testimony of eyewitnesses. The problem I had was that in his approach to a person who was obviously mentally ill, he approached him like he was a criminal suspect, despite the fact he'd had training to the contrary. And it was his unwillingness to use his training that other officers had used with the same individual, I might add, sometime before, that set off a chain of events that resulted in the death. So I decided that although, you know, he hadn't committed a crime, his failure to use the appropriate training was egregious enough that it was ultimately officer-created jeopardy, and I fired him. And yes, I ended up with a vote of no confidence from the police union. You've got to take those risks sometime. There is a sense of solidarity among officers working in the street, and I think most of them perceived that I was firing him for trying to protect himself rather than firing him for what I perceived to be an egregious violation of policy. But that's something chiefs have to do. And I think over the course of time, when you keep reinforcing that message, a critical mass of the officers understand and move forward.
You mentioned the importance of training. We heard a moment ago from Joe Dominic about broken windows and how it can be deployed appropriately or not appropriately. That, I presume, depends on the training. What's necessary to make broken windows work if, in fact, you try to make it work in Milwaukee?
Well, the first thing you do, and we do try to make it work here, because one of the things I learned, my police career started in Jersey City. And as a young cop, I could never understand that when I went to a community meeting, you know, accompanying the precinct captain, he would get up there and give them all the latest crime data about robberies and shootings and burglaries and drug arrests. And then that neighborhood would complain about kids loitering on the corner, double parkers, and boombox radios. I'm talking about poor neighborhoods of color, particularly, who were bombarded by both the most crime and the most disorder. And we cops in that era were saying, what's wrong with these folks? They don't get it. It's about serious crime. And those folks were saying to the cops, they don't get it. We want to live in a peaceful community. So fast forward years later, and the broken windows theory is developed. And the point of it was police have to recognize their responsibility as guardians of the public space or the people who are using that public space, that the police are the ones that can get communities to work together and organize together for their own protection, provided the police are not experienced as an occupying force, but are experienced as doing the community's will. The big mistake that happened, and this was mainly politicians, not police departments, but it transmogrified into police departments, was confusing broken windows with notions of zero tolerance. Now, anytime you hear anybody say zero tolerance for anything, you know you're headed for trouble. And what happened was they were putting pressure on police departments, and police departments that didn't understand the theory were doing it. They were arresting people for minor violations no matter what.
Okay, well, hold that thought to Ed Flynn, chief of the Milwaukee Police Department. We're going to take a very brief break later on our talking point, women and the GOP. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Norman Olney back with To The Point, talking today about police repression and police reform. We've just heard Ed Flynn, the chief of the Milwaukee Police Department, say that the theory of broken windows, that you need to enforce the law against small crimes in order to prevent larger crimes from occurring, creating the wrong kind of environment, is sometimes mistaken for zero tolerance, and that when it becomes zero tolerance, that's a recipe for trouble. Let me introduce Janae Nelson, Associate Director and Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She joins us from New York City. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Do you think that broken windows is a policy that can effectively be used and that you can have community policing along with it?
There are so many concerns about broken windows policing, and I think in order to really unpack it, we need to go back to the original theory of it, which is this notion that if there's a broken window and it's not repaired, then people who have broken the window will assume no one cares about the building, more windows will be broken, more crime will be committed, and soon the entire community will disintegrate into disorder and chaos. I think it's a big leap from a single broken window, if you will, or a single act of some public disorder to ultimate chaos within a community. I think Chief Flynn and others are certainly right that every community wants a certain degree of a quality of life. But what we have to look at is what chaos the broken windows policing theory and practice causes in and of itself. What it does is wreak havoc on communities by arresting and introducing primarily youth and young adults to the criminal justice system over very minor infractions, giving them a record in the criminal justice system that they will carry then for the rest of their lives and will therefore be left out of and isolated from so many opportunities for advancement and for building a quality of life for themselves and their community. So the consequences of broken windows policing, even if it worked, far outweigh the benefit of stopping minor infractions of the law. And I'll say that there are many other ways to go about this. Police can have a very different interaction with communities, and this goes into the question about community policing, that could encourage behavior that is more beneficial, that increases the quality of life of a community by gaining the trust of that community, by encouraging better behavior without the stick of an arrest and a stop. There are so many ways in which police officers can build a rapport with community members that encourages no loitering, no public urination, no loud distractions, no any various and sundry ways in which the quality of life in a community might be lessened. The police can play a very important role in inspiring community members to act in a more positive way without using the ultimate stick of an arrest.
Does broken windows become a kind of excuse for racial profiling?
Well, absolutely. The implementation of broken windows policy is extraordinarily concerning, and it's something that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund that I have the pleasure of leading with the other attorneys here, we've litigated against New York and the New York City Housing Authority case, Davis, that we recently settled, that came on the heels of the Floyd case that ended the stop and frisk policy that you mentioned at the outset of the show, where it was held unconstitutional because of the disparate impact, the disproportionate harm that it causes to African Americans and Latinos in New York City. And we saw that also occurring in the housing projects of New York City, where officers were stopping and holding individuals for trespass, the guests of residents of New York City housing projects as trespassing by the discriminate use of different criminal policies. So it can be abused. It can be wielded in a way that ultimately is racist and discriminatory and extraordinarily harmful, and that's what we found in those two recent lawsuits, and it's what's happening in many places across the country.
Janae Nelson, again, Associate Director, Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York City. George Kelling is on the line. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. He's one of the two people who developed the theory of broken windows 30 years ago, the other being the late criminologist James Q. Wilson. George Kelling, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
How do you react to what we have heard so far today? Is what Janae Nelson is referring to an appropriate use of broken windows? Is there a way to do it right?
Absolutely, and if people would bother reading carefully what Jim Wilson and I have since written, they would understand that for me, broken windows was always an integral part of community policing. And that is, you can do broken windows at great risk outside of community policing, but it has to be, if properly conducted, it has to be part of community policing. I got the ideas of broken windows talking with African-American and other minority groups in churches and basements, and if they talk about the problems they were confronted with, Chief Flynn has talked about this, the problems that they're confronted with, 3 out of 4, 4 out of 5, have to do with disorderly conditions and situations. And there's a demand for order that runs through the African-American community like it runs through any other community. Now, it seems to me that we have to try and figure out where some breakdowns occur. The first is there's a theory of broken windows, and that has to be gotten right. You have to understand that broken windows, from the beginning, did not advocate arrest. It advocated doing something or getting somebody else to do something, like, for example, the graffiti on the New York City subway. The graffiti there was resolved not by the police, but by maintenance people. A young man would be alive in New York City in public housing if the housing authority had changed the light bulb, which had gone out. So we want something done about it, but it does not mean that the push is towards arrest.
So it goes beyond the police, then?
Pardon me?
It goes beyond the police.
Oh, way beyond the police. In fact, that's why the argument from the very beginning, from a second piece that Jim and I wrote in The Atlantic, where we tried to make sure that broken windows is understood as a problem-solving technique within community policing. And in practice, many times that idea has been lost, but the idea, it seems to me, has proven its effectiveness in terms of responding to the demand, especially in high-crime neighborhoods. And so what the representative of the New York City Civil Liberties Union said about the proper application of broken windows, I have no quarrel with that. And I think Chief Flynn was very appropriate when he said, you know, when it gets confused with zero tolerance, or it gets confused with an arrest quota, or arrest is seen as the primary means, it seems to me that from the beginning, Jim and I argued that arrest is the last resort rather than the first resort.
Let me go back to Joe Dominic, our first guest, who wrote Blue, the LAPD, in the Battle to Redeem American Policing. How many police departments, and is this true in Los Angeles, are willing to make arrest the last resort?
Well, I don't think too many are. And I think the reason is that that police like to operate in a gray area. And it's very difficult to get, and they love control. They want to have, unless they're very thoughtful, like Chief Flynn, for example, they want to have as much power as they can have. And what we see is they will take as much power as they're given. And inevitably, many leaders aren't thoughtful. And what happens is they resort to these policies like what we just described, where they just use it on a mass scale to control. One of the major missions of police ever since the fugitive slave laws in the 1850s was to control African Americans, keep them down and keep them in their place. And I think that that's what happens a lot more than it doesn't happen.
Janae Wilson, back to you with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. What do you say to what we heard from George Kelling, that if you do it right, if you make arrest the last resort, if you get other agencies in addition to the police involved and civilian people who aren't parts of any particular agency, then it makes sense?
Well, what Mr. Wilson is saying is that there are ways in which you can improve broken windows policing. And, of course, whenever you have a system that is flawed and problematic, there are ways that perhaps you can do it better. But that does not get at the underlying concern that there really is no proof of a direct link between disorder and crime. Many of the broken windows crimes, the minor infractions, the misdemeanors that attract the police's attention to Black and Latino communities are a result of poverty, are a result of lack of education, and the disproportionate policing in those communities is a result of racism, is a result of assuming that these communities have a higher criminality and assigning more police presence to those communities, which then engenders a relationship with a criminal justice system that perpetuates that myth. So I think that, you know, we can talk about ways to improve it around the edges, but what we really need to be getting at is how sound of a policy is this in the first place, unless we have demonstrated proof that there is a direct relationship between these petty offenses and reducing more violent, more serious crimes, and that is the best way of going about that crime reduction.
All right, let me go back to George Kelling, again with the Manhattan Institute, the originator of the idea of broken windows. What do you say to that, that there's no link between the kind of disorder you've talked about and that's objected to by people in all neighborhoods and serious crime?
Well, that argument has been put forward a long time. I would refer the last speaker to the Journal of Research in Crime and Delinquency, a special July issue that gives accounts of the relationship between disorderly behavior, broken windows policing, order maintenance, let's call it that, and crime control. There have been now at least two formal experiments in the United States, one in Lowell, Massachusetts, the other in Jersey City, New Jersey, plus experiments in the Netherlands that have demonstrated quite strongly a positive link. Now, does that mean that the literature is not mixed? No, the literature is mixed, but increasingly we're discovering with the best research, there's increasingly little doubt about the relationship between order maintenance and reduction in crime. And again, I'd refer to the Journal of Research in Crime and Delinquency. The July issue was completely dedicated to broken windows and includes criticisms of broken windows as well.
Let me go back to Ed Flynn, the chief of the Milwaukee Police Department. You're caught in the middle.
Well, I'm caught in the middle, but I feel in the middle when it comes to pontificators, talking heads, theorists, and ideologues. I don't feel like I'm caught in the middle when I'm in the neighborhood, because the poor neighborhoods of color in my city and in every major city in America are plagued by extraordinary levels of violent crime, of which they are the primary victims. I mean, every single year in Milwaukee, 85% of my homicide victims are poor people of color, overwhelmingly African American. 90% of my non-fatal shooting victims, 60% of my robbery victims, 85% of my aggravated assault victims. You know, we take a map of Milwaukee and we overlay the areas that have the highest rates of unemployment, the lowest rates of high school graduates, and the highest rates of poverty. And we lay over the city our violent crimes, our calls for service, our 911 calls for service. And guess what? Big surprise. They line up perfectly. Now, I was fed a bunch of malarkey as a rookie cop. Sociologists came into my class and would say, "You don't understand. Poor people have different standards of behavior. You've got to leave them alone." And what we did is we did leave them alone, much to the consternation, chagrin, and fury of the neighborhood residents at the meetings I would go to who would say, "You wouldn't tolerate this behavior in your neighborhood. Why are you tolerating it in my neighborhood?" Now, finally, the sociologists caught up. They started to write articles that said, "Gee whiz, people who are poor want to walk the streets in safety unharassed as well." Now, a lot of police departments got it wrong. A lot of police departments did it wrong. And a lot of them did it wrong at the behest of the political establishments for which they worked and the cultural expectations of that city. But I'll tell you right now, here in Milwaukee and cities like it, one of the biggest things keeping those neighborhoods poor is fear of crime and neighborhood disorganization because of that crime.
Okay, let me go back to you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're just about out of time. Janae Nelson, how do you respond to that?
Well, this could easily be a battle of the literature. I mean, I can refer listeners to Brooklyn.
No, but Ed Flynn is talking about what goes on the street.
No, I understand. And what's clear is, what harm is this policy causing without being justified as an actual and proven crime reduction tool? No one is questioning that everyone, and of course African-American and Latino communities, deserve a high quality of life and deserve to be protected from violent crime. The question is, how do we best go about that? Is it by criminalizing more people in their community and having them entangled with a criminal justice system that is entirely unforgiving? Or is it about other ways in which to discourage that misconduct? And I can firmly say that looking at it from a different vantage point and discouraging that misconduct without involving those individuals in the criminal justice system is unequivocally a better way to
okay.
go.
All right. Hugely important to debate, one we will take up again and again on this program, as others will as well. Thank you all very much for being with us. Janae Nelson, Associate Director and Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York. George Kelling at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, one of the originators of the idea of broken windows. Ed Flynn, chief of the Milwaukee Police Department, recently by unanimous choice of the police commission reinstated for a third four-year term. And Joe Dominic, author most recently of Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. Thank you all very much for being on our show. Fox News backs Trump against Megyn Kelly. That's not from The Onion. It's a headline in Forbes magazine. What does it reveal about the Republican war against women and about the media? We'll separate the headlines from the punchlines in a moment with today's talking point.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Warren Olney here with today's talking point. During the week since the first two debates between Republican candidates for president, there's been saturation news coverage of Donald Trump's comment about Megyn Kelly at Fox News. He said there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her whatever. On CNN, GOP candidate Carly Fiorina had this to say.
I've had lots of men imply that I was unfit for decision making because maybe I was having my period. The point is, women understood that comment, and yes, it is offensive.
Liz Winstead is a writer, producer, and co-creator of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. She heads the nonprofit Lady Parts Justice, which uses comedy and digital media to provide perspective on American politics. Great to have you here in our studio.
Thank you.
What does this tell us about the Republicans and what's going on among their presidential candidates?
I think it the level of discourse when it comes, you know, now if we're at sixth grade humor, and also what does it really to me? The better question is, what does it tell us about how we teach our kids civics? You know, when you look at these 800 candidates on stage, and when Donald Trump has become this sort of populist hero by saying he's a loser, it's like, is that really how you want him to walk into international diplomacy? And the answer is, I think, yes.
To what extent is this the doing of the Republicans, particularly what's referred to as the war against women? To what extent is the media responsible?
I think I've always looked at the media as trying to find the soundbite and the thing that is the most interesting to play over and over again rather than the thing that makes us smarter, which is always terrifying. And now with Donald Trump pretty much replacing bed bugs as America's number one pest, I think the party, I'm trying to figure out if this is good or bad for Republicans. On the one hand, you know, I'm somebody who is unabashedly progressive in my views. I'll put it out there. So when I look at Donald Trump and I say, why are people paying so much attention to Donald Trump? I can't imagine he'll be the nominee. I wonder if the Republicans are quietly thinking, let him make all the noise because they think he's the one who is so outside the box. But if you were to look at comments from each of those people, you would find things that are similarly sexist or similarly just offensive. You know, when Eric Erickson from redstate.com, which is a right-wing website, is offended and disinvites Donald Trump because he has just walked a bridge too far, you just have to Google Eric Erickson and find out he is referred to Wendy Davis as abortion Barbie. He called Justice David Souter something I can't even say on your radio program that has to do with goats and fornicating and other things.
Keep us within the law here, if you will.
Yeah, I will. I'm really good about that, Warren. You can trust me. I'll take you to the line. I'll have you break into a sweat, and then I'll pull it back. But so the hypocrisy of that is insane. And today we find out that Ben Carson, a brain surgeon, has also used fetal tissue in his research, but said his was gotten through not profitable ways, which is just like, now you're going to backtrack on all of it. So I don't even know where to begin.
Well, here comes Carly Fiorina. Now,
yes.
She's the only one. You said there was a million. There's actually only 17, although it seems like a million. What about her? Is she going to rescue the Republicans from from what's called the war against women?
I don't think she's going to rescue Republicans. And, when you put a woman in front of issues and then she touts the issues that are not going to benefit women, women see through that. You know, we saw it with Sarah Palin. You know, when Hillary Clinton wasn't the nominee and John McCain was like, hey, let's get Sarah Palin. She'll get the Clinton vote. Being like, wait, she has zero of the same policies at all that women who actually liked Hillary Clinton for. So it's an insult to women to say women will just vote for a woman.
Yeah, but do people really vote for policies? If they did, would Trump be in the lead?
People haven't voted for Trump yet. You know, I think there's a really big difference, and it may sound wonky and nuancy, but people who like that Trump speaks his mind, that's different than saying, I'm totally voting for Trump. And I think when people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
When you say it's wonky and nuancy, it seems to me that's in itself a kind of commentary on the level of discourse that goes on about public affairs.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it would be hard-pressed to find, I think, a lot of folks who even know the names of all the 17 people that are running on the Republican side, right? And it just, I think we've just moved now into a society where people are working 2 and 3 jobs. They don't have time to pay attention. And so the little amount of soundbite they get is what they latch onto. And it's a little bit worrisome. And when you hear the lack of science, it terrifies me that we can say, well, you know, climate science is junk science. And it's like, except for every scientist thinks it's not. So.
But in this case, we had the debate with the top 10 candidates. Mm-hmm. Was one of the highest rated shows on television. It's right up there with sports programming. People really gravitated toward that. They wanted to see this Donald Trump.
They wanted to see the entire bombastic spectacle. Because the WWE nature of Donald Trump was astounding. We also, let's not forget, had 3 candidates who are not bombastic Donald Trump types who basically said that their positions were so extreme on a woman's right to choose that they would rather have 0 abortions and let a woman die than allow abortion to remain legal in America, which to me is a little bit scarier than Donald Trump, making a 5th grade boy joke about Megyn Kelly having her period.
Do you think that some of that audience, that enormous audience that tuned in, is going to have heard that?
Well, no. And I think, well, actually, I take that back. Yes, in the sense of the cheering that came from some of the most extreme comments. I mean, it felt like they all had a plan to go straight into war and blow people up and take women's rights away. And there was an active excitement about that. I think that those of us who watched it to see if we were going to hear any policy inklings heard what we thought we would hear, which is Obama, blah, 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 you know, Benghazi, blah, blah, blah. We don't have any policies. We're just angry. But I think it was red meat for a lot of people who feel anger, which isn't necessarily making people any smarter.
So you're an abashed progressive, as you indicated earlier. Should other unabashed progressives be happy about what's happening this? Should the Democrats be cheering Donald Trump?
You know, I what's good for a comedy is really bad for the nation almost always. So I stay in. I always, when you talk about voting against your own interest, I really do vote against my own interest. But I think that where the media is heading, I don't know. I guess I'm excited about Trump on one level that he is actually saying things to people's faces, which I do find kind of funny and refreshing. But on the other hand, when you look at the Democrats you have to choose from, are people going to listen to a populist like Bernie Sanders, who is never taken money from corporations and has an agenda that is unabashedly progressive? Or are they going to, or is Hillary Clinton going to be able to pull it out to be the candidate? I don't know. I think politics are funny, and politicians are always going to be have hypocrisy to them and be comedy fodder no matter how you vote, I think.
Well, that's a profound statement, it seems to me, which I have to agree with as a political reporter. But what about Bernie Sanders? I mean, isn't it kind of funny that he calls himself a socialist in this day and era?
I think it's awesome. You know, what I love authenticity, and it rears its head so rarely that when you see somebody who is unabashedly authentic, it is refreshing.
Quickly, back to Carly Fiorina, because we started out talking about her and talking about women's issues. She has a maternity policy of her own, doesn't she?
She does. You know, I think she was recently on, with Jake Tapper, and was saying, you know, I don't know that it's the federal government's business to dictate to corporate America that they should have regulations. And it's like, really? Oh, okay, so let's just erase all that and let the coal industry go howdy on our environment. Like, there has to be regulations. We live in a world where we have to have, I believe it's called governance, and she wants to be part of the plan of having governance. So I think she's a little misguided.
What's the silliest thing you've seen this year?
The silliest thing I've seen this year, oh, my gosh. It might be.
It's hard to remember, isn't it? Hard to count them all.
I think the silliest thing I've seen this year is Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it. All of those things do not need to go together.
Okay. Liz Winstead, again, one of the creators of The Daily Show, now with the nonprofit Lady Parts Justice. Great to have you on our program.
Thanks
for giving us some laughs.
Sure.
I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.